Colonel Michael Dimitriades, Real 5.
And quite often, people who'd been wounded and taken to that aid post were wounded again as they lay there waiting for treatment or evacuation. This happened quite a lot of times.
And evacuation would have been by plane, of course.
No, it wasn't. It was eventually not from Kohima. It was evacuation by when we could get any vehicles up to that point to take them away. And it wasn't until fairly late on in the siege that was possible.
Yes, one was wondering about access and how this changed, you know, as the siege went on.
For example, the advance to relieve Kohima started around the middle of April, but it wasn't until the 18th that the 1st Punjab Regiment reached the Indian garrison, Indian General Hospital Spur, with ambulances and tanks, and was able to evacuate some wounded. But really, the relief of the garrison didn't take place until the 20th, when the DLI opened the road to Bickett Hill and Garrison Hill, and the Royal Berkshires went in to relieve the garrison.
Did you know anything about the battle for the tennis court?
Horses were battling hard for the tennis court, and it was extraordinary, rather like a tennis match in one way, that one side was on one end of the court and the other side was on the other end, and they were fighting hard to get each other off, with a very steep hill going down to the court itself, so it was very difficult to get either up or down in any degree of practicability. It was all a very close investment in every sense of the word.
And your own headquarters, where was that position?
It was on Garrison Hill, right about the middle of it, just on the reverse slopes of the hill going away to the north. Near the battalion, whichever battalion happened to be there at the time. They changed over, of course.
And what did it consist of? You know,
Just a hole in the ground. Later on, of course, after this, the relief of Kohima, when we were advancing down towards Imphal, our battalion headquarters at that time, because I'd gone back to the battalion, was always a hole in the ground. We might be able to cut a shelf at one side to sit on, but at that time it was so wet that I used to sit on my map case to keep the bottom dry, and we probably had a tarpaulin over the top to keep most of the rain out. And one of the main features at that time were the leeches. Now, leeches are pretty horrible things. They're so small when they start off that they can crawl through the lace hole of your boot, and you never know that they're there because you don't feel them. And they crawl up your flesh, gorging themselves on your blood. And when eventually you have occasion to take your trousers off for one reason or another, you might find a thing as big as your thumb latched onto your thigh or anywhere else. And there are only two successful ways of getting rid of them. If you pull them off, they left their heads in, which went septic. The only two ways of getting them off were either to burn them at the end of a cigarette or put salt on them. And mostly they were burnt off with cigarette ends. But one of our officers, Dickie Sparrow, had a leech which got into him in a place where you simply couldn't put a cigarette end or a drop of salt, and he had to be evacuated, and I suppose the hospital got it out for him.
This would have been presumably through the monsoon season.
Yeah.
Which lasted quite a while, didn't it?
I forget how many weeks, but it was a long period, yes. And of course, what had been mud, dust became mud. And later on, what had been mud became dust.
So a pretty miserable existence.
Well, you know, you can say that, and yet personally I was always very grateful that we never had against us the weight of tanks, which must have been the case in Africa. In fact, I don't remember ever seeing a Japanese tank, nor particularly much in the way of Japanese aircraft overhead. I think that was a mitigating factor.
Did that change over time? You know, at the beginning, when you were first there, the beginning of 1943, would you say there was more Japanese presence in the air and less of the British, or Allied rather?
There wasn't very much of either at that time. There were some. We were certainly strafed in Chittagong, but only once, as far as I remember. And the odd bit at going down to Dunbike, but not a lot in either event. As we said earlier, the difficulty of spotting targets and hitting them without doing collateral damage.
I was going to ask you, when you were talking about your intelligence work, you know, and the problems of getting radio communications, but whether you were getting, or whether you would have been involved at any rate, in the breaking of the Japanese codes, whether you were getting messages.
We certainly didn't, but I think Southeast Asia Command headquarters did. But we're not at our level, we were far too low down.
Yes, you wouldn't have known.
No, they knew nothing about it.
No.
Nothing about it at all.
How important was the saving of Kohima and Imphal from the Japanese?
It was important in a number of ways, in as much as it stopped the Japanese from invading India. It stopped them living off the land as they'd planned to do, instead of dragging all their supplies across mountain ranges and rivers, which they hadn't got any means of doing. And it stopped them attacking the Chinese from the southwest. And having a go at General James Stilwell's Chinese forces, and of course invasion of India. So every which way it was an imperative operation to be won. And I think furthermore, it really made the British, when I say British I include Indian and Gurkha, and African troops realize that the Japanese were not invincible and we were just as good in the jungle as they were once we'd learned how to do it.
Did you have any idea of how the Japanese had fared in that battle for Kohima and Imphal? Would you have seen dead Japanese?
Oh, any amount of
and
them.
And wounded or prisoners?
Not prisoners. I don't think we ever. I don't remember that we took prisoners. We didn't. It's a funny thing about fighting the Japanese. I have to say this. We did not, unless the British troops, I can't speak for the others, did not regard Japanese soldiers almost as being human. They didn't appear to be the same sort of people that the rest of us were. They were more regarded, I suppose, cruelly speaking, almost as animals, but certainly not as human beings one could feel for. A Japanese would never allow himself to be taken prisoner. He would rather hold a grenade to his stomach and blow himself apart. Some of their anti-tank weapons were to dig a hole and put a Japanese soldier in it with an anti-tank mine. So the tank would go over it and he'd blow it up with himself and everything else. I shot one Japanese. I had absolutely no compunction about it at all. I don't think I need have done. He was lying asleep in some bushes. And when I came across him, he went for his belt as if he was going for a grenade, and I just shot him. My batman complained bitterly, I shot along his arm, and he felt the wind of my bullet. But I'm afraid that was it. There was no compunction about it. We just shot him, and that was that. They were pretty wretched, those that we saw, starving in many cases, diseased, and in a very poor way.
Supply must have been one of their...
Well, their supply went wrong, because I mean it was an enormous, long supply from their bases in Rangoon or Mandalay or whatever else, across the rivers and across the mountain ranges. And they'd relied, they did, I think they started driving bullocks and so on with them. And they did, but they did rely upon getting, capturing supplies from Imphal and Kohima and anyone else they overran in the way, which they didn't, weren't able to do.
Did you come up against the INA at this time?
I personally never.
What was the opinion of that group?
I thought we thought they were a pretty useless lot. They didn't contribute to the Japanese effort. The Japanese hoped they would, as far as I understand it, but I don't think they had any tangible effect on the Japanese efforts at all. They might conceivably have made some of the Indian troops have doubts as to what they were doing, but I never heard of it.
Kohima would have occurred about the same time as the invasion of Normandy, wouldn't it? And I was wondering, you know, was it overshadowed by that at all in terms of world news? Would you have been aware of that anyway?
Well, as you know, we called ourselves the Forgotten Army, and we think we were. I don't think the outside world heard much about what we were doing and how we were getting on. I think all the resources, too, the main resources were directed towards Europe. And I think Mountbatten had a terrible job getting hold of equipment that he required for the war in Burma, particularly aircraft.
Yes, you were saying earlier how your amphibious craft had been taken away for that, I suppose.
That was for Italy.
All part of this process.
Yes.
Yes. How did people feel about that? Was there a lot of moaning or resentment?
I think just a bit of frustration rather than anything else, having set out to do something we couldn't do, we had to do something else instead. One of the things I remember doing our amphibious training, I mentioned about passing everybody having to pass a swimming test. One time they decided, our soldiers decided that the May Wests we were issued with for landing purposes, just an inflatable thing that went round our chests, would not keep us afloat if we were drowned in the water or upset into deep water. So I said, well, I'll show you. And I put on a May West, I put on full equipment, and I took all the weight that you'd have. And I walked into a tank of water with my May West blown up. And I went down and down and down until just the edge of my tin hat was level with the water. So I said, there you are, it keeps you afloat. Well, of course, if you were conscious, you could have made some effort to keep your head above water with that amount of flotation. But if you'd been wounded and couldn't move, you probably wouldn't have survived. Another thing we learnt to do, and thank goodness we never had to do it, was in attacking or landing on assault landing on a beach protected by barbed wire, the idea was that the leading people would fling themselves across the barbed wire and those following would run over their backs. That was the training. Thank goodness we never did it.
Did you actually, you never did it in training?
We did it in training, but we never did it in for real.
What happened in training doing that? Were people injured?
I suppose they got scratched a bit, yes. But people, they weren't being shot at, so it wasn't quite so horrendous.
Yes, you would have been pinned on the wire, presumably.
Yes, we probably didn't put up the most terrific wire defences either, knowing to do that.
So after Kohima, what were your movements then? You know, did you go forward with the advance?
Well, we went on down through Burma. There was a thing called the Kama Weir, not very far from Shwebo, which was very important to capture because that controlled the irrigation of the whole of the delta, and we were able to secure that. On New Year's Day, I suppose it must have been 1945.
What was the name of that?
Cabo, K-A-B-O, Weir.
Cabo Weir. And how easy was that to take? Were you involved at all in
the... I personally wasn't. One of our officers got a military cross for the success of that operation, Douglas Littler. But I personally wasn't involved in it. Our battalion, but it was a company affair rather than anything larger than that. Then we went on across Sierra Madre, and that was a fairly opposed crossing. The assault craft we were given were not very satisfactory. The rubber boats were shot up. A lot of the outboard engines weren't very successful. But we made a crossing and established ourselves on the other side of the Irrawaddy.
It's a vast river, isn't
it? Yes.
How easy was it to, you know, to get across, given that you had...
Well, at that time, we were able to cross by a very long pontoon, which was built for us and guarded by the West Africans.
That must have been quite an operation. Getting a whole lot of men across a river of that size.
Well, initially, of course, we weren't involved in the initial setting up of the pontoon. We drove across it after it was established, so it wasn't too bad. But later on, we had another river whose name I've forgotten for the moment to cross, and that was really quite hair-raising.
But you were saying your crossing was opposed.
Initially, yes, that one, but. As I say, we went there, so I can't speak much about it.
Was that a big thing, though, to actually be across the Irrawaddy?
Oh, yes, because we had to get east, first to get Mandalay, and then on to Rangoon. But Mandalay was the main objective at that time. And whereas our division went south of Mandalay and made a sort of stop, 19 Division came down from the north to actually attack Mandalay. Meanwhile, Slim had put up a completely dummy divisional headquarters with fake messages and one thing or another to deceive the Japanese what his intention was.
And they were deceived,
I think,
weren't they? So. Yes. So, what was your experience, you know, going in, taking the southern route?
Well, apart from this river crossing at a place called Angazun, N-G-E-Z-U-N, which was opposed. We didn't have very much to do until later on, after Mandalay, when we were going along a trail beside a railway line, and we got an intercept on the telephone line beside the railway of Japanese talking to each other, and we got an interpreter up the pole. And he was able to tell us that the Japanese were getting very excited about an important train leaving that night with important Japanese officers leaving from Ichinar and stopping at Palaik, P-A-L-E-I-K, which was where we'd reached at that moment. South of Palaik, there's a place called Chaukse, K-Y-A-U-K-S-E. And we thought it would be a good idea to try and cut the railway line so that train didn't get south to Rangoon, which is its ultimate destination. And so, with a small party of engineers, I set off for us to blow this line. And after a fairly hairy patrol in the dark, we found a railway line and eventually blew a hole in it. Meantime, the signalers were still listening in on this intercept on the telephone line, and the gunners were firing over our heads to begin with on the Japanese, but as they got word over the intercept that the Japanese would say, "How is that falling near you?" He said, "Oh no, it was way off to the left or the right or whatever." And the gunners were able to make a correction, and we were getting slowly or closely bracketed by our own artillery. However, they didn't descend upon us. And after a while, having watched a whole lot of Japanese soldiers marching down the road past us, we did blow a hole in the line and got home again. There is some doubt as to exactly where we blew up the line and exactly where the train was going. In the event, it didn't really matter because the gunner's shelling had wrecked the water tower. They couldn't water the engine, so the train couldn't go anyway. But it was quite an interesting episode.
Were you meeting much resistance, you know, as you were going south?
Not a lot at this time, no. I think the real hard fighting was over and done with by then, as far as we were concerned.
And I suppose Dombek by Kandan Kohima was the worst, was it?
Oh, undoubtedly. No doubt about that, whatever. And Aradura, if you throw that in as a separate issue or not. But after that, we flew back. Extraordinary system. We flew back to Calcutta by courtesy of American Decatur aircraft. I forget the name of the landing strip, but we all formed up there. And the second commander got up to the pilot and said, would you take a back load? And if he agreed, we filled it up with soldiers and flew them back to Calcutta. And eventually we got all the battalion back there into Calcutta. From there, we were supposed to do an assault on Rangoon, but while we're still at sea, sailing down, the prisoners in Rangoon, the prisoners the Japanese had taken in Rangoon, had been released, and they'd written on top of the godowns, "Japs gone extract digital," was the effect to the Air Force, and we realised that the Rangoon was not occupied by the Japanese, so we did a completely unopposed landing at Rangoon and went south of the river to a place called Sirium, where Syriam, where we set up camp. And from there, we established a water patrol and a naval high-duty motor launch to a place called Bassein on the edge of the Delta, which was thought to be the headquarters of some Japanese, but they weren't any there. However, we liberated Bassein, we made very welcome there, and the town band turned out and played in our honour, and in fact came all the way back to Sirium with us. And there we had another change of command. Jack Stocker left us to become a brigadier, and one of our officers, Philip Carrington, took over for a while, until we got another South Wales boarder in the name of Colonel Crewe Reed. He wasn't with us very long before it was time for VJ Day to be announced and the battalion, or what was left of it, to start to go home. In the meantime, I personally had left the battalion to go over to the mainland, become the DAA and QMG at Headquarters 6th Brigade, my old headquarters where I'd been Brigade Intelligence Officer.
So what did that involve, your new post?
Well, the DAA and QMG are responsible for all administration within the brigade. Everything you can think of, from rations to courts-martial. I had an office in the Rangoon Jail, which was a curious situation because twice a day, just outside my cell window, because I was in a big cell, they had a flogging parade of locals who had been convicted of black marketeering. And these men were strapped to an A-frame, stripped, and beaten with a cane. I don't think it was the most severe punishment in the world, but they used to holler like anything before the first stroke hit them. From there, I saw the 1st Battalion go home, saw them off in a ship, and the Royal Berkshires had disappeared, the DLI went, and I was left for the DLI and the Brigade Headquarters, and I was the only person left in Brigade Headquarters. So I thought there was not much point in staying here. And I flew out to Kandy and asked for another job, and Kandy was Ceylon was the headquarters of Southeast Asia Command. And I was posted to become DAA and QMG doing the same job in 4th Brigade, the other brigade, left in the division. I don't know what happened to Fire Brigade by then. Four Brigade. And with them, I went into, we landed at Singapore, but we went and established ourselves across the causeway in Johor Bahru, where we were really on internal security duties.
That's quite a lot of ground you've covered, haven't you?
Yeah, I never added it up. I don't know what mileage is.
Rangoon onwards.
Yes.
I was wondering, you know, with the end of the war, the dropping of the atomic bomb, did that make any impression on you? Did you have any idea of the unusual nature of it?
I don't recall that we did at the time. We probably didn't have enough detail about it, and certainly not enough visual detail.
Did the end of the war seem to come very quickly, bearing in mind the very strong resistance that the Japanese had put up? You know, their very, as you say, tenaciousness and fighting to the death.
Well, I think the war generally was tailing off. We'd had VE Day, that was passed out of the way. We then had VJ Day, and that was passed out of the way. The fighting had tailed off to nothing, and such Japanese as we had were being used as servants and working parties. So that I don't think it was a gradual tapering off, I think, of activity. I don't think it was a sudden termination of everything.
How were the Japanese treated, you know, bearing in mind the nature of the fighting? And I understand they were quite cruel troops. You know, they didn't take wounded, for instance, did they?
Well, the Japanese had this code that it was a disgrace to become a prisoner. And therefore, I suppose, that was mainly the reason why they were never taken prisoner. But at the same time, they couldn't understand. It wasn't within their comprehension to understand how British troops could surrender, as they had done in Singapore. It was quite beyond their comprehension. They were, for all I've read and heard, pretty rotten to the prisoners they took. But I think once the war was over, I never heard of any Japanese who'd been, I would say liberated, but been released from serving the Japanese army, running amok and being beasted to people. I think they were probably rather cowed.
Was there any retribution against them, so far as you know?
Not that I ever saw. I wouldn't say there wasn't, but I never saw any.
How about the Burmese? How did they behave during the war? You know, could you count on them for sort of loyalty and help?
Or no, I don't think one could. The Nagas, certainly. They were most loyal and helpful and cooperative people. But the Burmans, I think they've been wanting to cast off the British yoke for quite a long while. And one of the disappointing things, I think, about our war is, whereas in Europe, Allied forces liberating a town were greeted with the population with gifts and hugs and kisses and this and the other, if you so-called liberated a Burmese town, well, people didn't really want to know, by and large. If you find anybody to want to know. I don't think we really had an opportunity to experience the sort of liberation joys which the Europeans must have had. One little example of conditions. The way through part of the territory was by bulldozing a vehicle track through the whatever the terrain was like. And of course, at that time, the monsoon was over, it became terribly, terribly dusty. So to allay the dust, palm fronds used to be cut down and laid over the surface of the road. That was fine, it kept the dust down, but this was the sort of road where you could only take signal line traffic. And to control a battalion column, which I as adjutant had to do from time to time, the only way to do it was on a motorbike. I used to take a motorbike up and down the column so that I could see what was going on. But it was fine, but you try riding a motorbike over a corrugated road where the bumps are all hidden by palm leaves and you get a very bumpy ride.